This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on The People Speak Radio, filling in for Bessemer Farhat. At The People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to The People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also log into our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Paltalk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. We broadcast 1 hour live to the USA, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. If you have questions for our guests during the show, you can call 415-762-1160 or 712-432-0075, access number 318-116. You can also listen and call via your smartphone, so you never have to miss the best guest on internet radio. Now, tonight I'm with you with Barry Schwartz. Now, Barry is the official documenting photographer for the Shroud of Turin Research Project, Incorporated, back in 1978. He was on the first scientific examination of the Shroud. Now, rather than go into a lot of my own opinions here, Barry, could you tell us what the Shroud of Turin is, what it's believed to be, how you got involved in the project?
Okay, well, that'll take an hour. Anyway, the Shroud of Turin is a 14.5-foot long, 3.5-foot wide sheet of linen cloth that bears markings on it, the image of a man crucified, blood stains from the appropriate forensic areas on the body, the wrists, the feet, the side wound, scourge marks on both sides of the body, more on the back than the front, blood stains on the head as if from a cap or crown of thorns, and it is believed by many to be the cloth that wrapped Jesus after he was placed in the tomb. Now, as far as my involvement goes, I'm a professional photographer, had a studio in Santa Barbara, California. Back in the 70s, I was approached to do a 9-month project for Los Alamos National Laboratories as a consultant. I completed that, and one of the men that I had worked with on that project, Don Devan, called me back a few months later, and he asked me, Barry, what do you know about the Shroud of Turin? And I kind of laughed, and I said, well, Don, I'm Jewish, so I don't know much about it, and really doesn't matter much to me. And he reminded me that he, too, is Jewish. He happened to be one of the other Jewish members of the Shroud of Turin Research Project, ultimately. And he told me that they had sort of visualized a new or a previously not well-recognized property of the Shroud's image, and that was that three-dimensional or spatial information was encoded into the Shroud's image in a manner unlike any photographic or artistic process. There's a correlation between the darkness of the image on the Shroud and the distance it was from the cloth, with the darkest areas being where the body came in direct contact with the cloth, but imaging took place up to 4 centimeters distant between cloth and body, and the image grows more faint as the distance increased. So that's spatial information that normal photography and normal artworks don't include.
Okay, now, you said something while you were talking about getting involved in the project, and my first instinct when my producer asked me to do this interview was I've read about the Shroud over the years, just passing references or short articles, and my first reaction was like, so who cares? Why does it matter?
Well, I think for a lot of people it doesn't matter, and I think for those who are people of faith to whom Jesus is significant in their lives, there are, you know, 1 billion Catholics or so on the planet alone, then to them this is sort of an artifact of that man. It documents the wounds that he suffered. so I think that there's a very logical reason why people of faith are interested in this. When you get to somebody like myself who had no emotional ties to it, I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home. My parents were from Poland. It was sort of fiddler on the roof at our home. And so, you know, there was really no emotional ties, and I frankly figured it was probably a painting of some sort of artwork or something. And I expected to go to Turin and see the brushstrokes and the paint and come home and be finished. I never anticipated that 33 years later I'd be on the radio talking about it still.
Now, like I said, I mentioned before the show that I am a painter, and I realize that pigments are bits of metal, ground metal, or other substances, and that even a vegetable-based pigment would decay and leave marks of the decay in the fabric. So are you telling us there's no evidence of any pigment or the vehicle that it was suspended in or any of this left?
That is absolutely correct. There is no paint, no pigment, no binders, none of the things that would be associated with medieval or Renaissance art. The tests that we took to use to examine the shroud were tests designed to look for or to evaluate artworks. So we were looking for that. We had X-ray fluorescent reflectance with us to look for any lead-based pigments and to see what else we could learn about the cloth. We X-rayed it. We had UV fluorescence, infrared photography, fluorescence and reflectance photography, UV. So we had, and there was a whole series of spectral data taken from the shroud. So we were taking credible data that would have identified, especially the spectral data, any kind of paint particulates. I mean, for example, there's some red iron oxide scattered evenly and microscopically across the entire shroud. Red iron oxide is an ingredient of a medieval pigment. However, all of the medieval pigment has not only red iron oxide, but cobalt, manganese, several other elements in it that we don't find on the shroud. But we've learned that a byproduct of the retting process, when they soak the flax plants to turn them soft and so they can be spun into a twine, the byproduct of that is the production of red iron oxide, pure red iron oxide, and that's exactly what we found on the shroud. And if you took it all into one pile, scraped it all together into one pile, you'd still need a microscope to see it. It is absolutely not responsible for the image on the shroud, nor is there any more of it deposited in the image areas than in the absolute non-image areas. So we've ruled out painting, pigments, and any of those types of particles, and that information's in peer-reviewed literature. That's not just an opinion that somebody voiced. The data is readily available through these peer-reviewed articles that were published by our team after we completed our work.
Okay, now, so then that takes us to the fabric of the shroud itself. You said that the red iron oxide is a byproduct of the process to soften the fibers for being made into threads for weaving.
Right, the retting of the flax plant.
Now, I read that the carbon dating that they tried on it wasn't real effective. Have they been able to determine the age of the shroud, and if so, by what means?
No. The only dating that's ever been done from the standpoint of a scientific dating was the radiocarbon dating of 1988. When that came out, it yielded a medieval date, and a lot of people walked away and said, aha. The only problem is there's this vast amount of other information, scientific information, historical information, that indicates this particular piece of cloth is considerably older than that. So we have this question about the radiocarbon dating, and in recent years, several different theories have been proposed, several of them in peer-reviewed scientific publications, I might add, that indicate that there was something anomalous about the sample corner used. One little tiny corner was cut away and divided in thirds, and that's what the laboratories used. So what we really have is a radiocarbon date done on one tiny little sample area of the shroud that apparently was not representative of the main body of the shroud cloth. As a matter of fact, on our website on shroud.com is an article, 60 pages of documented evidence showing people, other researchers, making reference to the anomaly of this particular corner of this particular sample. And there's a vast amount of evidence that indicates that what was used for radiocarbon dating just didn't represent the main body of the shroud cloth.
Okay, now, is there other ways to determine it? Like, is there a specific, can they pinpoint a time frame when this particular method for manufacturing cloth? Or
well,
that this,
this is kind of a unique... I'm sorry. I didn't hear your complete question. Well, this type of weave, this herringbone weave, twill, 3/2, is not a common weave, but it is something that would have been available in the first century. As a matter of fact, the earliest example of a herringbone twill is actually 500 BC. So that type of weaving is not unheard of. In the first century, this would have probably been manufactured perhaps in Syria, where to this day they still manufacture herringbone woven cloths using a similar twill. The reason that if you look at what the gospel accounts are, they say that the cloth was provided by Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy man. This would have been an imported piece of cloth into Jerusalem and consequently would have come in probably on a caravan and would have been considered an expensive piece of cloth. Interestingly enough, the Torah, the Old Testament, requires people to be buried in pure linen raiments, and this is very consistent with that, although typically a cloth of this quality would have been reserved for people of stature, somebody of higher stature, a Pharisee or someone of that nature. So it would not have been the most common cloth used, but certainly would have existed in that first century. We also know that the linen itself was manufactured using the ancient method, and there's basically three eras of linen manufacture. I won't go into detail, but the shroud is manufactured by the ancient method.
Okay, but was this method, like you said, they still use a similar weave in Syria to this day, so it's also equally possible that similar fabric could have been available in medieval.
There's one hitch to that theory. Linen is now manufactured using chemical bleaches. Ancient linen was not manufactured using chemical bleaches. It was bleached in the sun, and each batch was bleached a little differently because they left them out there for X amount of time and then brought them in and put them onto the loom. So we can see the various batches in the shroud linen by some photographs that I made in 78 of light transmitted through the cloth. You can see the bands running throughout the entire cloth from the different batches of linen that were used to assemble that cloth. So I think that relegating this the weave alone, it's the actual manufacturing of the linen, the way it was manufactured in ancient times, that we find in the shroud that we don't find in medieval or modern linens.
Okay, now I have been to your website, and I've looked at the photographs there, and they're incredible. Now I take it these are your photographs, the famous
right.
ones we see everywhere. And
most
never put
time,
a name
yeah.
to them. But one thing that I was curious about, of course, there's places on the shroud where it would correlate with what would have been bloodstains.
Correct.
Now, I've read somewhere that this has been positively identified as blood. How is that possible?
Well, it's possible by looking for components of human blood chemically in the bloodstained areas. Dr. Alan Adler, a world-renowned blood chemist, also Jewish, by the way, and who was a member of our team, was the man who did the blood chemistry. That was his field of expertise. And Adler's work showed hemoglobin, bilirubin, I think serum albumin, a number of components of human blood. And there's been some blood typing done on it, although it turns out that the enzymes responsible for blood typing degrade over time, and after a while, all old blood seems to yield a type AB, so that's not really a great point of comparison. However, there are peer-reviewed scientific journal articles by Al Adler and John Heller, both experts in blood, that verify that this is real blood. There was also a DNA analysis done in 1995 that determined male human blood. So I think that we can rest assured that it is. Adding to that the fact that the forensic experts who have studied the shroud as if it were a crime scene all agree unanimously that the blood stains themselves are actual natural blood flows. They're not applied or painted on by the hand of an artist. They've actually come in contact with the body and by capillarity have soaked into the shroud.
Okay. Now, again, I'm not real familiar with the science of it. We've eliminated the possibility that this was painted on or dyed. Now, something else, and I'm kind of curious about this in the site. Obviously, paints and dyes are also suspended in liquid, which would penetrate the fibers.
Correct.
Now, am I understanding that whatever made the image did not penetrate the fibers?
You've done your homework. I'm impressed, Jeanette. Absolutely correct. The image itself rests on the top few micron surface of the fibers, never penetrated into the cloth. There's no image, virtually none, on the reverse side of the cloth, but the blood stains do soak through, as one would expect from a liquid coming in contact with a porous cloth. So you're right. The image is on the surface of the fibers, which is why it's so subtle to the eye and difficult to photograph because of its subtle nature. The image is only about 7% darker than the background, so that's not a big range of contrast there. So you're very correct about that. The image is on the surface, pretty much eliminating any kind of capillarity, which would be any liquid applied.
Okay, so then here we are. We've eliminated out most normal means of applying an image to a fabric, a background.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the most plausible theory of how that image was created?
You know, it's sort of ironic that our team went to Turin to answer a single question, how is the image formed? And when we came back, we could sort of tell you what it wasn't. Not a painting, not a photograph, no silver salts anywhere on the cloth, and image properties unlike those made by light and photography. But in the end, we really couldn't come up with a single mechanism that would account for the chemistry and physics of the image of the Shroud of Turin. And so that question remains basically unanswered, although there are a number of theories that have been proposed by researchers, including one of our team members, Ray Rogers, who died in 2005, and he was a chemist at Los Alamos and was looking for some kind of chemical interaction between the cloth and the body, and determined that there was a chemical reaction known as a Maillard reaction that might account for these image properties, and it does account for some of the most difficult image properties of the shroud. What I described earlier, the cloth body distance equal to density, darkness of image, that would have been explained with Rogers' theory. It's pretty complex in its chemistry, which is beyond my scope in most areas, but there is an article on shroud.com by Ray Rogers, and it's titled Maillard Reaction, et cetera, et cetera. So you just look up the word Maillard Reaction, and it'll take you right to that article. And you might want to read that, or your listeners might want to read that. It's far more complicated than I can explain easily on the radio. And also, the other thing is this. I'm not an expert. It's much easier to read it from the horse's mouth than for me trying to paraphrase it. But in general, it does provide a natural explanation for the image, but it can't seem to account for the image resolution that we find on the shroud. And that's why many pro-shroud, pro-authenticity shroud researchers don't accept this particular theory of Ray Rogers because they don't feel it can create an image with this level of resolution. There are several other image theories that are out there, including coronal discharge, which we often call Curlian photography in the modern age. But that would require about 100,000 continuous volts. It's pretty hard to imagine where you'd get that in a first century cave. So, but that's one of the theories that's been proposed. So there are still theories out there that now take into account the image properties that we've characterized by our science, our team science, trying to determine an image formation mechanism that fits within the known science of the shroud. And so far, nobody's come up with an answer that can satisfy all the chemistry and physics.
Okay, and for me, the key word would be the known science. Because science unfolds new facts and new information
every day.
Almost daily.
Yep.
So at some point in the future, the mechanism by which this image was formed could be discovered or yet to be discovered.
Would that
be a reason alone for studying the shroud to by discovering the mechanism that created the image you might be
considering that the reason we're talking about this piece of cloth is that it bears this image, obviously, yes, the answer would be yes, that it's worth pursuing. Now, somebody said to me, well, Well, can you ever prove it's Jesus? And the answer is no, of course not. Science can never prove who that man is. So in the end, maybe the answer to the shroud isn't just about science, but people have to rely on their own faith to decide what it might mean to them. And, you know, it didn't come with a book of instructions. It didn't come with a guide to tell us what to think or what to believe or how to believe. It's just there, and we have to sort of take what we know about it and decide for ourselves, what does that mean to me? And I think each individual has to do that. So I think that there's room for people to study it. There's room to study its history, to study the science of it, and also to study the religious implication. There are many people out there who study it from a biblical point of view or a historical point of view. So, there, you know, it's one object that's a mystery that covers so many different kind of genres of information, science, history, art. And you really, it's much deeper than most people realize, and I found that out the hard way. Spent the last 33 years of my life studying it, and realized that, you know, we've really only scratched the surface, if I can use a bad pun. But I think that really where we stand is that we know a lot more about it than when we began in 1978. As an example, our team requested the dimensions of the clock so we could build and construct a special custom stainless steel table where we could hold the shroud on it with magnets and do no harm to the cloth. They gave us the dimensions. We built the table. We arrived in Turin. When we put the shroud on it, the table was about 3 inches short, indicating that as late as 1978, they didn't even have accurate dimensions on this cloth. So we've contributed a great amount of knowledge to the database, the knowledge base of the shroud, but there's still a lot of questions to be answered, a lot of information that has not yet been conclusively determined. So I think there's still room to go with it.
Okay, now, one of the things you said is that, of course, we could never prove that, while it's very possible that it can be established that this is indeed a burial cloth of some man in the first century, it could never be established that it was, in fact, Jesus Christ, simply because we don't have a sample of his DNA.
That's
but
exactly
my reading
right.
tells me there's a more complicated reason why a DNA sampling would be irrelevant in this particular case.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, the biggest issue will be contamination. Thousands of people have handled the shroud through the centuries, including me. My DNA is on it, too. And we all breathed on it and touched it and leaned over it, so we all left our DNA. We wind up shedding a lot more DNA than we realize, and that's just in the last 2 or 3 years that we've learned that. So there's lots of different DNA on the shroud, and it's very hard to isolate it and be certain what you're getting is what's originally there. But putting that aside, the problem with DNA, as they found out in 95 when they did a preliminary PCR analysis of the shroud, was that the DNA is so degraded that no profile, no complete profile of any kind, can be obtained from it. There's just a few remaining segments, enough to determine male and human, but not enough to get a profile that could be comparatively analyzed to another DNA profile, which is, of course, how DNA works. So, again, you're right on the money that DNA analysis can tell us some things, but we can't be certain because of contamination that we're getting a pure sample, and secondly, what's really there, the original old material, is so old and degraded. We know it's, you know, at least 700 years old, so DNA after about 100, 125 years, especially open to the air the way this DNA would be, unlike DNA in the marrow of a bone that could be, you know, they can get DNA analysis profiles from old bones, but that's because it's encapsulated within that bone and protected from the air. So the problem with bloodstains on a sheet of linen that's exposed to the air is that the DNA segments will degrade over time.
Okay, now, one of the other things, and I know that they were aware of this even prior to the scientific investigation, is obviously a shroud, a sheet of this type, was wound around the body. And one of the reasons that a lot would never believe that it could have been an artwork is because of the correlations of the fold with the...
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say that you have to be careful with the word wrapped and the way it's wrapped. The first century Jews were not buried in Egyptian-style wrappings like a mummy. They were buried in a single burial cloth. As a matter of fact, my father, when he died in 2003, was put in a shroud very similar to the Shroud of Turin. Because he had an Orthodox Jewish burial. But there is a talk in the Gospel about linen strips, and people confuse that with mummy strips. Well, that's different. When you wrap, when you lay a cloth down, put somebody's head in the middle of it and wrap the cloth over their head and down to their feet, which is the way the shroud was placed over the body, you then, if you're going to move that body at all, the cloth just going to come right off. So you bind it around the neck, around the chest, around the feet with linen strips, and that keeps the body within the cocoon, if you will, of the shroud. And so that is what we would expect to find, and that is what we do find on the shroud. It also explains why we have a ventral and dorsal front and back image, head-to-head, basically, with some adequate space in between, and we have what we is considered a standard high-quality first-century Jewish burial shroud. And it matches the Mishnah and the Torah's requirements, and it's consistent even with the New Testament gospel accounts of what was done with Jesus.
So it's what you have found is consistent with accounts that are non-scientific, historical record, known customs, which also tells us that if this was a hoax perpetrated 1400 or 1500 years later, these people would have had to have known.
They would have had to have known more than we know now, because we can't create an image with these properties today with all of our imaging technologies. And they're trying everything from lasers to gaseous discharge. I mean, there's just all of these various types of mechanisms that are being tested, but not one has yielded an image that even comes close to the properties of the image on the shroud.
So I have another question. If this is, you know, I don't understand the Millard theory myself, but if this were created by some natural process that we can already theorize, have there been other burial shrouds found with similar images? It seems like
no. No, and here's a real important reason for it. There is no evidence of liquid decay on the Shroud of Turin, meaning that it was separated from the body it wrapped before the body began to liquefy and decay. Typical burial shrouds are placed into the ground in a tomb with the body within them, and as the body decays, so does the cloth. And so it's rare to find an intact Jewish burial shroud from the first century because the body decayed along with, and the cloth decayed with it. What we have with the shroud, which makes it maybe, again, another kind of unique point about it, is for some reason this was separated from the body it wrapped. We know that it wrapped a body, and we know there's no liquid putrefaction or signs of liquid decay anywhere on the cloth. And so he had to have been removed before the body began to, you know, decompose or dramatically decompose. And so, you know, that in itself is quite unique because most bodies stay in their shrouds and go in the grave. And when we find them X number of years, centuries, or millennia later, what remains is what's left after all the decomposition products have gone away. So we don't have that sort of evidence with the shroud. It's obvious that this cloth was separated from its body.
So, again, that tends to support the account given in the New Testament where Christ was, again, seen after he was supposedly buried, and if his body did not decay, that would explain why there's no decomposition.
That's
so
correct.
Do you understand the Millard theory to understand well enough that it would have, would it be something that would have had to occur after death? Is it part
it would
of the decomposition?
Have, yes, because basically, when they manufacture a cloth, I'm going to try and be real brief on this so it doesn't put everybody to sleep, but in the ancient way of manufacturing a cloth, once you wove the linen, it was kind of stiff. It's not soft like cotton. It's sort of a stiffer cloth, a stiffer fiber. So they would wash it in saponaria, soapweed. It's a naturally occurring detergent, acted as a fabric softener. They would rinse it and then air dry it, and by evaporation, there would be a deposit of this sugar, this polysaccharide, this residue of saponaria on the top surface of the fibers, only a couple of microns thin, and Rogers determined that was the case, and so he looked for something that would affect that sugar coating, if you will, and impact it in a way that would cause it to discolor, and he determined a Maillard reaction would, and he determined that the amines escaping from a body, which include ammonia gas right after death, comes out of our lungs, nose, and mouth, but eventually through our pores, are these products of decomposition called amines. And these amines, as the body more and more decomposes, become heavier and more intense, So you get to cadaverine and putrescine, which are the ones that make the horrible smell of death. But at the very beginning stages of decomposition, you have these coming out of the body through all the pores of the body. They would create a Maillard reaction with this sugar that's on the surface and discolor it. And it's the same chemical reaction that makes beer its golden color and bread its golden color, is a Maillard reaction. So it is something well known, well documented within the world of chemistry as a very common type of chemical reaction.
But the body would have to decay, and the body and the clock.
Well, remember that those start escaping from our body right after death. So the liquefaction of a body is going to be dependent on a number of conditions: temperature, humidity, whether it's in the sun or in the shade. There are all these factors involved, but bodies don't usually start to liquefy and decay until 36, 48 hours later, or even longer, again, depending on conditions. We don't see any of these products anywhere on the shroud, indicating that the cloth and the body were separated at some point before any of this liquid decay would have begun. Basically, we have a plausible scientific explanation for an image of this nature, but other experts have said, well, you know, it's not going to yield the sharp quality image that we see, the highly resolved image that we seem to see on the shroud. And again, you know, my opinion is that may be the case, but right now it's the only theory that anyone has proposed, to my knowledge, that would account for the cloth body distance and density correlation of the image on the shroud. The Maillard reaction would sort of provide us with a mechanism that could do that. Nobody else's theory seems to come anywhere close to that. So again, we have to take the actual image properties of the shroud itself, and we have to study its chemistry and physics, and then say, okay, if you're going to make a duplicate, then we have to test the chemistry and physics to see if you matched it or not. And nobody's ever come close. I mean, I've looked at all of them for the last 30 years, every effort, and nobody's even come close. So I think that the answer to the question, how is the image formed, remains open. I don't think there's an absolute definitive answer to that, even at this stage of the game. And that's pretty ironic when you consider this object, this piece of cloth, is the most studied artifact in human history. More hours have been spent studying the Shroud of Turin than any other single artifact. And so that in itself is a pretty powerful statement that there's something about this that we still don't understand that warrants further study.
Okay, now as a photographer, you got involved as a photographer.
I did.
Have I missed anything in the course of our discussion that as a photographer that you found particularly significant, interesting, or just, gosh, as a photographer, I'd like to be able to duplicate that effect?
Well, not so much the latter, but, you know, when I first got involved with this, it was the one image property that the shroud has that photographs don't have, and that is a correlation between image density and distance. In other words, the brightness of something hitting my sensitive sheet of film or my image sensor in my digital camera, the reflectivity or the absorption characteristics of the object I'm photographing will reflect light back that is focused on the sensor by the lens, whether that's film or digital. And yet the image on the shroud seems to be darkest where it touched, and as the distance, you know, where the hands, for example, were across the torso, it raised the cloth away from the body. Well, if you look at the hands, you'll see there's sort of a halo around the hands where the cloth was raised away from the torso, and there's less image of the torso in that area surrounding the hands where the cloth would have been raised away from, up to about 4 or 5 centimeters away from the body. And, you know, there's nothing in photography that can duplicate that. So as far as I'm concerned, that was sort of the image property that hooked me at the beginning. And, of course, now 30-some years later, there are all these other facts about it that make it so unique that, of course, are just as interesting. But as a professional photographer, it was that fact alone that kept me on the team when I was ready to quit. I didn't really feel that interested in it, but that image property sort of hooked me in because I know we can't make that kind of an image photographically.
Okay, as an artist, when you're describing that to me, I'm thinking in terms of depth perspective, that this is capturing depth.
No, it's, you know, I understand perspective pretty well myself, It's not a function of perspective. It's a question of literally image density versus distance. And that's different than perspective. I mean, artists use scale for perspective, but if you look at medieval artwork, you'll see that they weren't using much depth perspective in medieval times. That didn't come until a little later. So it doesn't have any of the characteristics of an artwork where there would be the kind of foreshortening that you as an artist might incorporate into your artwork. We don't have that. We have a contact, near contact kind of thing going on that's a little difficult to understand outside of perhaps that Maillard reaction is, in my mind, the best explanation so far from a purely scientific point of view.
Okay. Now, I'm getting a few questions here from the audience, from Ron in Nebraska. He's asking, with you being Jewish, can you tell us the Jewish view of who Jesus was and who your own belief of what Jesus was?
Sure. Well, of course, Jews consider Jesus a prophet, and some Jews accept him as the Messiah, and they are Messianic Jews. But apparently, again, I'm certainly no expert even on Judaism, there were enough things that didn't fulfill the prophecies at that point for the general consensus of the Jewish population not to accept that he was the Messiah. From my own point of view, the personal part of the answer is that I don't know. I am not sure if he was the Messiah. It's not the answer that people want to hear, but it's the honest answer that the jury is still out in my mind. I don't know if he was or not. What I have learned, though, is that it's not incumbent on my personal beliefs to go out and give people the accurate information about the shroud. And my personal beliefs, you know, it sort of doesn't matter because obviously I'm not doing this because of my religious beliefs. I mean, that should be apparent that was not what motivated me. As a matter of fact, that's what almost kept me off of the team because I felt uncomfortable being involved in what I thought was this Christian relic thing. And so from my personal perspective, and I'll be candid with you, this whole thing, it took 18 years after I held it in my hands and left my DNA on it before the scientific evidence finally convinced me that it was authentic. I didn't rush into it. And by 1995, I'd come to accept it as authentic. And when I spoke publicly and built the website to share the data, the scientific data that had convinced even me, the questions changed and people started asking me what I believed. And they were no longer talking about the shroud. They were talking about my faith. Well, I'd walked away from it when I was a kid and didn't even have a clue what I believed. So it did force me to confront my own beliefs and reconnect. I mean, I was raised in an Orthodox home where God was part of everything every day anyway. And so it's sort of not unexpected that when I sort of opened my heart up and looked, I found that I did have a faith in a greater power, but not necessarily in an institutionalized religious organization. And so it did reconnect me to my faith in God, maybe, but not so much to my participation in any of the institutional religions.
Okay, now I have a question from April in Wyoming. Will the Catholic Church now allow further scientific study of the shroud? Why haven't they given more access? Because it would seem that its validation would do wonders for the Church.
Well, it's a very good question and a very valid point. But the other fear is this, that every time it comes out, it's at greater risk of damage, loss. I mean, people have tried to destroy it through its history. The security issues become very great. And as far as scientific access, there have been some rather embarrassing moments in recent years. I'll tell you this. I was in Turin in May of this year and then went to Rome to lecture there. And I spoke to the people in Rome that are sort of getting involved with the shroud now, and I can see that the attitude is shifting back towards science. So I'm hopeful that in the not too distant future, not immediately, but maybe in the next few years, we'll see a kind of an opening up of the shroud again, perhaps to scientific inquiry. But I think it will be formal, much like our team was. I think it will be a multidisciplinary team. It will be of experts in various disciplines. It will be carefully planned. Again, I'm describing exactly what our team did in 1978. We had a 100-page test plan that was submitted well in advance of our ever getting permission to examine the shroud. Every possible experiment was planned in advance. We spent almost 2 years planning before we left for Turin in 1978. So we didn't rush into it, and I think any future research is going to be done carefully, and that's good. That's the right approach, and I think that that's been lacking in recent years. And I think what's good about it is that this could reopen it to science in a very credible and professional way, and perhaps give us an opportunity to learn more about it.
Now, you were part of the very first scientific study back in 1978. I have a question from Delia in the USA. Who instigated that study, and why did they want the study done? Somebody obviously paid for it.
Well, believe it or not, well, not exactly. It's a very good question. Great audience. I love the questions. The way it happened was sort of by chance at the beginning. A couple of guys were working at Los Alamos National Laboratory. They were from the Air Force Academy, and they were physicists. And they happened to hook up with my friend Don Devan that I had worked with in their imaging laboratory, and they knew of this device they had over at Sandia Laboratories, a sister lab, another explosives lab in Los Alamos area. And they took an image of the shroud, a photograph of the shroud over there, and put it in this device called a VP8 image analyzer. And all it does is it takes the lights and darks of an image and converts them to vertical relief, you know, stretches them vertically. When they put the shroud photograph in there, it yielded the natural relief of a human form. A normal photograph doesn't. A normal artwork doesn't. So that was sort of that image property that they discovered that sort of led them to say, well, let's see if we can put a team together and maybe we can figure out how this image was formed. And so they started what became STIRP. As far as funding goes, none of us were paid. We were all volunteers. There was payment for our hotel rooms and our airline tickets from a private foundation that had no influence on the science, nor did the church, even though we had to do liaison work with what was then called the Holy Shroud Guild. Basically, four priests, one had passed away here in the U.S. that were promoting the shroud from a religious point of view. But we had to liaise with the Turin authorities. The church is the custodian of the shroud, or it was at the time, and the owner of the shroud was King Umberto, the deposed king of Italy that lived in Portugal. He was the one who granted us permission, and then we had to work with the church authorities, who were the caretakers or custodians of the shroud, to organize and coordinate our effort with the cloth. So I'm not sure if I'm answering the question, but what started off basically is a bunch of us just volunteering to be involved with this and try and figure out how this worked. I know that National Geographic gave the organization $2,500. I know that the photographs of mine that appeared in Life, there was $750 that went into the organization for that. So in other words, there was really nobody profiting from it, and we were a nonprofit, and there was really very little money, barely covered our expenses. As a matter of fact, I had to go to my banker and borrow $1,000 so I'd have some money to go to Italy, to go to Europe with. I was sort of self-employed and didn't have a lot of cash handy. And my banker just sort of looked at me funny and said, well, okay, you have a good record with us, so sure, we'll loan you the money. But he didn't even know what I was talking about when I said the Shroud of Turin, and this was 1978. So it was not really organized and funded by a single entity that was looking to get an answer here. It was a bunch of scientists whose own curiosity sort of piqued their interest enough to try and put a team together, and eventually that got formalized, and some people put up some money to enable us to go and do that. But ultimately, our airline tickets and our hotels were reimbursed, but everything else we paid for ourselves, and none of us were compensated for our time.
So, now I have one more question about a technical aspect of the shroud that came to me when trying to authenticate it. Obviously, some things in the history have been authenticated by the presence of dust that's only specific to one area, or vegetation.
Pollen. That was pollen you're talking about.
Pollen.
Yeah. Well, you know, the pollen evidence isn't as strong as some of the other evidence, and I'll tell you why. The pollen evidence was taken both by our team using special sticky tape to lift particulates off the surface of the cloth. And by another researcher named Max Fry, who is a Swiss criminalist, who pioneered the idea of using scotch tape as something to lift material off of the crime victims to see if they could analyze it and determine where they'd been, stuff like that. Max reported a certain amount of pollen, as did Ray Rogers, who did our pollen study, and both reported a similar amount of pollen. Unfortunately, Fry died before he was able to finalize his work or publish it in peer-reviewed journal, and more recent reports of the pollens are showing a much higher pollen count now than Fry had originally reported or Rogers had reported. Fry and Rogers reported about the same amount. So there's a question about that, and the sadness is, in 2002, they restored the shroud. They removed all the patches, removed the backing cloth, put on a brighter and whiter one. They scraped away all the char material around all the burn holes. They sort of stretched it out. It's now 7 centimeters longer than it was before they began. They exposed it to the air for 32 days. The woman who did the work on it didn't wear gloves, hairnet, mask, protective clothing, so she left her DNA all over it. And because of that, they also did some vacuuming after the scraping. So there's no formal pollen study can ever be done in the future because they disrupted all that. So unfortunately, we don't have the same level of scientific data on the pollen that we do with some of the chemistry and physics and spectral data that we have of the shroud. And so the pollen evidence, although it's used by many shroud, pro-shroud people as, you know, part of the body of evidence in favor of its authenticity, from a scientific point of view, I don't see it quite as strong or valid as some of the other data we have.
Okay, now I have another audience question here from Louise in Arkansas. I think the shroud is special because it's a tangible relic that has been studied scientifically, and unlike the Holy Grail or the Spear of Christ or anything else, this has stood the test of time and continues to mystify people. Do you have any stories of paranormal events or miracles associated with the shroud that you experienced?
Well, personally, I think it's a miracle that I'm involved with the shroud at all. So I guess if we're going to be a little tongue-in-cheek about it. But being serious, the Catholic Church, to my knowledge, has never formally recognized any miracles directly attributed to the shroud. Now, there have been other people who have reported, you know, that they were healed when they saw it or saw a replica of it, but none of those are formally approved, recognized by the authorities of the church. For myself, you know, people always ask me what I felt in the room, and it wasn't as much an emotional experience at that moment for me as it was one of just sort of frustration. We got there, our equipment got hung up in customs for 5 days, and so we were down to a day and a half when they finally released it, and we were so pressed, we were there a week early to get it all set up, and they wouldn't give us our gear. And so that last day and a half, we didn't have time to do much thinking. We had to get everything up and running, and then there was the shroud. So there was never quite, we had to set aside our emotional responses, our personal feelings, and sort of work on it. Now, that is being spoken from my lips, not being a Christian. I would not have had the emotional attachment some of the other guys might have had. There were some Christians on our team. And to them, it might have been a more deeply moving and spiritual experience than it was for me. So I cannot speak for anyone but myself in answering the question. But I think that that each person sort of found his own place with it over time. And it took me a lot longer than maybe most. But I was very uncomfortable. Now I'm very comfortable. I mean, as my 87-year-old Jewish mother points out, hey, that guy on the shroud's Jewish. So so she has kind of a positive attitude about it. And my Jewish friends in general feel that the scientific data, at least those that I've discussed it with, feel that the scientific data is powerful enough that if I've spent all these years studying it and I'm convinced, that's good enough for them. The ironic part of it, I think, is that the biggest skeptics are almost inevitably Christians. So the ironic part for me is standing in front of a group of Christians having to deal with Christian skeptics, and here I am, a guy to whom this shouldn't even matter, defending it as authentic because the evidence, the scientific evidence, is what led me to believe that. So it's kind of an odd position I find myself in. But I'm not going to have the same emotional response, perhaps, that somebody else would that was involved that was also Christian.
Or perhaps the skepticism, the tough skeptics among the Christians come from an underlying fear of being proven wrong. I'm not saying one way or the other, but
no, Jeanette, that is a very valid statement, and I think that there are people who are fearful of it from both sides of the fence. You know, this thing, if it's authentic, sort of goes against all the conventional wisdom that we have. So you've got people of science who are somewhat fearful of it because, gee, what if it proves something outside of their realm? And you have people of faith who say, well, what if they prove it's a fake? That sort of takes something away from my beliefs. So people all have their own inherent fears, positive or negative, about the Shroud. Maybe that's what makes it so controversial. Maybe that's what makes it so emotionally charged in many respects. But at the same time, I think that's also what makes it so important. You know, it forces people to sort of confront their beliefs, to think about it, at least, if they take it seriously enough to even read about it. And it makes people think about it. To me, that in itself is a good thing in this day and age. Anything that makes us think about our beliefs, our faith, God, whatever you want to call it, I think is a good thing. And I think it's important that, you know, that people have these symbolic items that make them think of that. I mean, look, people pray before a crucifix or other symbols of their faith, and you know, they're not praying to the crucifix. They're using that as a vehicle to get to the greater power that's beyond it. And I think perhaps the Shroud is the same kind of thing. Is it? It gives people a focal point, something to look at, something that's meaningful to their faith. And I don't see that there's anything wrong with that. I think it's a great gift to those to whom this is important.
So now, given now you were part of the first scientific team, there's been other research done on it since. So
not
here
much.
We are. It's been pretty much authenticated as a first century burial shroud that typifies what would have been used for a better off Jewish male of the time. That
yeah,
much.
Somebody of some means, remembering that Jews could be buried in other types of burial shrouds. They could be buried in cotton. They could be buried in wool. But typically, and they just a year or so ago found a tomb with a first century Jewish male buried in a wool cloth. And immediately they said, oh, that proves the shroud's a fake. No. All that proves is that first century Jews could be buried in more than one kind of cloth. Turns out the man whose body was found was a leper. And so, you know, in the first century, an expensive piece of cloth on a leper, never going to happen. They put him in a cheap cloth because he had leprosy. So to me, you know, it's kind of funny how people try and twist things to fit their own points of view. Maybe that's the great advantage I've had right from the beginning. I don't have my own point of view. It didn't matter to me. And maybe that's why my sort of testimony to the data about the Shroud is more powerful, is because I didn't even want to do this. And yet the evidence is the evidence. I cannot dispute the science. I helped to collect it, to reduce it, to publish it, and study it over all these years. And so for me, you know, I have to be honest about it. And that's really where I find myself, that I share this with people, because I know it matters to some people and it doesn't to others. And I'm not on any kind of crusade to convince anybody of anything. A man said that to me after one of my lectures, said, well, you know, it's a great lecture, but you'll never convince me. And I said, I'll never try. What makes you think I care what you believe? That's between you and God. Take it up with him. You know, my job isn't to save people's souls. I always tell any priest that I'm around that that's their job, not mine. My job is to give people facts about the Shroud, to be honest about it, to do so without an agenda other than to be candid. And that's what I do.
Now, as I said, what we've authenticated, the time and the place, the type, you've verified that this image isn't made by any known process.
Correct.
Even a person who is totally agnostic or atheistic would seem like they would be curious as to how the image itself would create it, science behind it. So religion,
exactly.
Take religion out of it, and
well,
you still
me,
have of the
yeah,
science
the religion
of how
was never
earth.
Really part of it for me or for any of our team members. Now, there were some Christians on our team, and I'm sure that to some of them, this was a more meaningful experience when we were in the room with it than it would have been for others. That's a given, you know, and I don't have a problem with that. But I don't think that religion really entered into our work, because half those guys would have got up and walked out if it had been even mentioned. These were scientists from Los Alamos National Labs and Sandia Labs and the Air Force Weapons Laboratory and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And these were all top-notch scientists working for our government. So these weren't a bunch of wild-eyed religious fanatics, a bunch of kooks, or a bunch of people with some agenda other than to try and figure out how the image was formed on that piece of cloth. That was what we did.
So, in fact, what's been accomplished is not to have disproven anything. What has been established correlates with the historical documentation, well, as historical as the Bible could be.
Exactly.
So it's still either way. It could be, it could not be. It was either a man of means or a man who was greatly respected was wrapped in that cloth.
Exactly. Exactly. And you're right. I mean, we can, you know, it comes to a point where, does it matter? I mean, really, that's the ultimate question. What does it matter? And like I said at the beginning, I think that this represents faith to a lot of people on this planet. This is the foundation of their faith, as a matter of fact. And so, even though I didn't take it very seriously at the beginning, over time I came to realize that whatever I thought didn't matter. What mattered was that the people to whom this is important have access to the truth. They can then use that in whatever way they feel is necessary in their lives to either fortify their faith or to discount it or to walk away or whatever they want to do. But I think it's imperative on those of us who have been privileged enough to study this piece of cloth firsthand and in person to give accurate information and access to those facts to anybody who's interested.
So for those who profoundly believe this is the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, the basis of all Christianity, you would not be able to dispute that. But I do have one more question. I've also noticed that the image on the cloth, the face, remarkably resembles a great deal of artwork that comes from the medieval era as how Christ was depicted after death.
Actually, not just from medieval times, but from pre-medieval times. The earliest known depiction of Jesus looking like the Man of the Shroud is 285 A.D., I believe, in the Domitia catacombs in Rome. And there's a whole list of iconography that has very similar markings to what we find on the Shroud, and it is theorized by some historical experts and art historians that many of these icons were based on the image of the Shroud. Because you're right, it's kind of interesting when you show that photograph to somebody, they go, oh, that's Jesus, as if somehow we all know that that's Jesus. And it's ironic that we have this picture of him in our mind, and if you look throughout the history of art, you'll see that most of the time he's depicted looking like the Man of the Shroud.
Yeah, that was one of the things that struck me about the Shroud, which probably gave rise to a lot of the skepticism this was a created piece of artwork.
Correct. Except that here's one of the ironic things real quickly here. As far as artwork goes, Jesus is hardly ever in art history depicted completely nude. Yet the man on the Shroud is completely nude. So why would this medieval artist go against convention and do something that none of the artists, other artists ever did? Why would they depict him naked when Jesus is always depicted with a modesty cloth of some sort? And that's typical. Yeah, typical in artworks going all the way back. So
that's another point to bring up right at the end of the show. We're out of time now, Barry. I so much appreciate you being here with us tonight. This was absolutely fascinating, even though, again, I'm a skeptic. I can't say what it is.
I enjoy skeptics more than the people who are already accepting, because it challenges me to answer the questions properly.
Okay, well, thank you, Barry. I want to thank the audience. We will come back next week for The People Speak, 8:55 to 9:55 Eastern Time, or 9, whatever. So thank you all, and you all have a good night. And thank you again, Barry. Maybe again sometime we can get into the rest of the art part of it.
Okay, I look forward to it.
Okay, thank you.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people. stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.